You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Our parable this morning is found in three of the five Gospels, Matthew, Luke, and the Gospel of Thomas. It's portrayed as a dinner for friends, a great banquet, a king's feast for his son's wedding, with maybe a little messianic banquet on the side. As we've already discussed, not only was Jesus not the only rabbi of his day to use parables, it was also not unusual for him to borrow material from already existing stories for the express purpose of throwing a wrench into the works. Our parable today appears to have been adapted from a story in Deuteronomy, which you remember Jesus is not on the best of terms with. The common theme between the two is people making excuses for non-participation. The difference being that in Deuteronomy, people have excuses to not be conscripted for war. Here's the Deuteronomy version. Then the officers shall speak to the people, saying, "What man is there that has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it. And what man is there that has planted a vineyard and has not enjoyed its fruit? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man enjoy its fruit. And what man is there that has betrothed a wife and has not taken her? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man take her." Once you hear Jesus' story, I think you'll agree that the similarities are obvious, and that Jesus was likely being intentional about creating tension between comparing being conscripted for war and being invited to a party. Although, as Brandon Scott says, unlike battles where people are killed, dinner parties are usually survived. We'll see about that. Thanksgiving is this week, after all.
Our words of wisdom are from Luke chapter 14, verses 16 through 24. Then Jesus said to him, "Someone gave a great dinner and invited many. At the time for the dinner, he sent his slave to say to those who had been invited,
'Come, for everything is ready now.'
But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said to him,
'I have bought a piece of land, and I must go out and see it. Please accept my regrets.'
And another said,
'I have bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I am going to try them out. Please accept my regrets.'
Another said,
'I have just been married, and therefore I cannot come.'
So the slave returned and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and said to his slave,
'Go out at once into the streets and lanes of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame.'
And the slave said,
'Sir, what you ordered has been done, and there is still room.'
Then the master said to the slave,
'Go out into the roads and lanes and compel people to come in so that my house may be filled. For I tell you, none of those who were invited will taste my dinner.'"
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Experts argue whether it ever really happened or not, but a story comes to mind that is told about Winston Churchill to show what a wit he was. It's said that he was at a dinner party and poured himself into a chair, totally inebriated, next to a woman who couldn't refrain from objecting to his condition. She said, "Sir, you are disgustingly drunk." To which Churchill allegedly replied, Ah, yes, but in the morning I shall be sober and you shall still be ugly. Yikes. Sometimes parties don't go the way hosts plan them. And that was certainly the case for the party in our parable today. Instead of the parable of the great banquet, it might be better to call it the parable of what if nobody came? And let's consider the context. Clearly, the main character is a person of wealth and power who is throwing a party not only looking to increase his reputation, but in order to build up others' social indebtedness to him. After the invitations are sent out, each guest sends back what turns out to be pretty lame excuses for not being able to come. Don't you think that someone buying a piece of land would have inspected it first? Same with the oxen and the other commercial endeavors described in the Matthew and Thomas versions. Evidently, the guests have previously accepted the invitation, and the servant is only bringing a courtesy reminder. So, isn't it strange that the guy with the marriage excuse would have forgotten when he first accepted the invitation that, oh yeah, on the day of the feast, he was also kind of getting married? I'm reminded of the time one of my mentors, Reverend Roger Stressman, got out of a speaking engagement with a questionable scheduling conflict. I remember sitting in his office one February when he got a call inviting him to speak at an event months and months away, like in June, that he clearly did not want to attend. So he made a show of noisily shuffling a bunch of papers on his desk. And then he told the caller, I'm sorry, but it looks like I have a funeral that day. Wink. You know, the caller apologized and expressed sympathy. You know, the excuses in our parable are pretty much just as shaky as Roger's. In fact, they almost have the appearance of being a concerted effort on the part of those invited. Brandon Scott says, it almost appears to be a conspiracy or a case of social snobbery. It's always possible that one or two guests would be unable to attend at the last minute, but all the guests? The hearer is left to speculate about the reason for what appears to be an insult. But the bottom line is that the host is being snubbed or shamed. So the question is, how is he going to maintain his honor? The dinner is ready, but the banquet hall is empty. And so the host sends his servant out to replace the absent guests with anyone he can find off the streets. Dom Crossan points out that when Luke tells the story, he mentions outcasts were called into the meal. And Matthew specifically mentions the good and bad are invited in. Think about how just grabbing people off the street would have resulted in a mix of sexes, classes, and social ranks all mixed up together. You'd have anyone sitting next to anyone, or reclining as they would have done back in Jesus' day. Female next to male, scandalous. Free next to slave, scandalous. Socially high next to socially low, ritually pure next to ritually impure. And all of it was a scandal. It would have been a social nightmare and a threat to all the carefully constructed conventions of social life in the first century. So what's the big deal, you ask? It's just a bunch of people getting together to eat a free meal. Oh yeah? To this day, who we eat with matters and says something about our religious, economic, social, and political status. Don't believe me? Think for a moment of a homeless person coming to your door. Maybe you'd give them some food to take with them on the road. But would you invite them into your kitchen for a meal? Or bring them into the dining room to have supper with your family, or have them come back Thursday for Thanksgiving dinner with your family and friends. Suppose you were the CEO in a large company. Think of the difference between holding a cocktail party in the office for all the employees, a lunch at a fancy restaurant for middle managers, or a private dinner party at your home for the vice presidents of the company. In the 21st century, as in the first century, who we invite to eat with us and in what sort of situation says a great deal about social standing and relationships. Think back just a few years ago to the start of the civil rights movement in the United States. Think of the mayhem that erupted at Woolworth's lunch counters when black young people sat there to order a sandwich or a soda. Our modern, enlightened, democratic society had rules about who could eat and drink where, when, and with whom. It was literally against the law for blacks to eat in certain places, and certainly for blacks and whites to eat together. That segregated lunch counter was a miniature model of the patterns of association in the segregated society as a whole. So when young people, black and white, broke the rules and sat around tables together to eat or rode together in the same bus, they were creating a new model of what the society should look like. The segregated table symbolized separation and discrimination. The open table symbolized community, oneness, equality. And wasn't that exactly what we see Jesus going for over and over again in his ministry? This parable makes a very pointed challenge to society's model of hierarchy and separation. And before you get all smug and think, well, this isn't about me, read the version of this story in the Gospel of Thomas. Thomas was written for a sophisticated, commercialized culture rife with consumerism. So we shouldn't be too surprised by Thomas's interpretation of the parable, with Jesus concluding, "Buyers and merchants will not enter the places of my Father." So good thing you're not a buyer or a merchant, right? The parable seems almost like rationale on Jesus' part for the way he lived his life. Calling together people of different genders, social classes, and religious scruples. You might remember that John the Baptist was accused of being possessed because he fasted. But Jesus was on the opposite extreme. He was accused of being a glutton and drunkard because he ate with sinners, tax collectors, and even whores. In both cases, we're talking about nasty name-calling. Jesus' critics were saying that he made no appropriate distinctions and discriminations. And since women were present when he was at table, especially unmarried women, the obvious accusation would be that Jesus eats with whores, whore being the standard insult directed at any female who was outside socially approved male control. In the opinion of the name callers, this was all dangerous business. So maybe we need to rename this parable altogether. And I mean, the parable of the non-discriminating table, that isn't very catchy, but how about the parable of only the right kind of people? Isn't that what we're talking about? Jesus is undermining the notion that the kingdom of God is only for the right kind of people. Because guess what? The right kind of people are too busy doing what the right kind of people do to be part of the kingdom. They're busy with land deals and building up their herd or finagling socially and financially beneficial relationships, which what was getting married was all about. Then and now, Jesus' egalitarian vision clashes fundamentally with the basic values of upstanding, upwardly mobile, proper society. And it's no wonder he got in trouble. Jesus' new habits of table association were probably a big part of the reason for his eventual arrest and execution. But what Jesus left behind was a tradition of sharing the table as a sign of the inclusiveness and the quality of life in the kingdom of God. Sadly, later followers of Jesus created the Last Supper ritual, and now it's not unusual for certain denominations to use certain beliefs as a litmus test as to whether you are the right kind of person or not to participate in the Last Supper. Think of it this way. Jesus basically says, the kingdom of God is like a feast where a host tries to build up his ego by inviting only the rich and the powerful, but who then ends up being stood up by the fickle loyalties of the sophisticated elite. Out of spite toward his so-called friends, the host throws open his doors to welcome the unclean and the outcast, saying to his former friends, I'll show them. The end. Thud. Like so many of Jesus' stories, that's where it ends, without any satisfactory resolution. Sure, the people are fed, but what about the hard-heartedness of the host? Who do you relate to in the story? You don't want to be the no-show invitees. We certainly aren't the demographic of those gathered from the streets and hillsides. If anybody, I think I'm most like the sniveling, insecure host. So in finishing this story in my own mind, my hope would be that the host would let go of his resentment and come to realize that placing his self-worth in cultivating friendships with only the right kind of people is a recipe for disappointment. Jesus says, look, for a bunch of elites, the kingdom of God is just another night out that they can skip if they get a better offer. But for the poor, the crippled, the blind, the lame, the excluded, and the outcast, who Jesus was telling this story to, the kingdom of God is like an unexpected celebration of abundance, belonging, and a reordering of what society looks like. In my imagination, I see the host discovering that, lo and behold, a party of previously unacquainted strangers, outcasts, and characters with questionable reputations are a lot more fun than all those society stuffed shirts anyway. Over and over again, the gospel challenges us to get over our infatuation with attending to the needs of or trying to become the right kind of people. To not let the structures or traditions of what we're comfortable with or what society dictates become the guiding force behind who's in and who's out. For Jesus, status or resources are not the defining value of a person. If you want a measure of a society, look at the way it embraces the basic dignity of every human being, not just the right kind of people. Embracing the richness and diversity of one another's basic humanity is the only measure that matters. As Jack Spong has said, the only way that God can be with us now and through the ages is for each of us to allow God to live and love through us, through our humanity. This afternoon is our 14th annual Interfaith Thanksgiving. And to come together as Americans of many different faiths and backgrounds today is more important than ever. Why? Because there are those who claim the mantle of being the right kind of people, who are trying to drive wedges of fear between us. Fear about another's skin color, country of origin, economic status, sexual orientation or gender identity, hijab, language, religion, or no religion at all. When Jesus told today's parable, he was casting a vision for a reimagined view of the world, this world, where every person is accorded basic human dignity and given every opportunity, even every advantage, to live life to the full. You might even say Jesus is an incorrigible humanist. He didn't come to make us more religious, righteous, moral, or orthodox, just more humane. The parable of only the right kind of people shines a light on the fragility of placing our self-worth in the fickle opinions and approval of society, and shows us that the fullness of the kingdom of God can only be realized when we embrace the needs of the poor, the crippled, the blind, the lame, the excluded, and the outcast. The metaphor of the empty banquet hall calls us to go out into the streets and invite everyone in. So in our own small way, we can be individuals and a community where every person can, in the words of Bishop Jack Spong, love wastefully and be all we possibly can be. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.